The weeks and months since October the 7th have shown both the strengths and the weaknesses of international law as a means to protect lives or as a means to achieving justice. To start with the weaknesses, Israel's war on Gaza has served as a reminder that any state's commitment to upholding human rights law often crumbles as soon as it's one of their allies in the dock. To take just one example among many, former human rights lawyer and leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, knew exactly what he thought about war crimes when an enemy of the UK was committing them. He's here speaking 3 weeks after Russia invaded Ukraine.
With your lawyer's hat on, is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
Yes.
Yes.
What I've seen already amounts to war crimes, particularly the awful attacks on civilians. And I think it's very important that he's held to account and is responsible. And all those that are acting with him know that they too will be held to account.
That was pretty clear. Now, compare it to Starmer's approach to Israel 3 weeks after they began their assault on Gaza.
I think it's unwise for politicians to stand on stages like this or to sit in television studios and pronounce day by day which acts may or may not be in accordance with international law. I think it's not the role of politicians. I don't think it's wise to do it. I come with the benefit of a lawyer of having litigated about issues like this in the past. And in my experience, it often takes weeks or months to assimilate the evidence and to then work out whether there may or may not have been a breach of international law. So I think the call for politicians to look at half a picture on the screen without the full information and form an instant judgment as to whether it's this side of the line or the other side of the line is extremely unwise, and I'm not going to get involved in that kind of exercise.
What a difference a year makes. It, of course, makes you wonder how serious Keir Starmer was the first time around. Of course, Starmer's lack of consistency is not the exception here, but the rule. I could have chosen Joe Biden, Rishi Sunak, Ursula von der Leyen, or pretty much any leading Western politician to make that depressing point. There are some positives, though, and that's this. Even if leading politicians have shown an aversion to consistency, international courts have provided one of the few venues in this conflict where Palestinians have got a fair hearing. And this order from the World Court in January was deemed by many to be historic.
The court considers that, with regard to the present situation, Israel must, in accordance with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, in relation to Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention. The court is also of the view that Israel must take measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to the members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip.
This month has also seen another case make its way to the International Court of Justice, this time about the legality of Israel's decades-long occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. Philippe Sands was one of the lawyers representing Palestine.
The right of self-determination requires that UN member states bring Israel's occupation to an immediate end. No aid, no assistance, no complicity, no contribution to forcible actions, no money, no arms, no trade, no nothing. All UN members are obliged by law to end Israel's presence on the territory of Palestine, period.
That was just one of many arguments given at the court with respect to Israel's occupation, many of them very powerful. But will that case, or South Africa's case against Israel, make any difference to Israel's actions on the ground? Can international courts force states to hold their peers to account for wrongdoing, even when they're their allies? And is that even what international law is meant for? Is international law really there to rein in the actions of powerful states, or is it a mere smokescreen to give a facade of humanity to a world system in which ultimately might still makes right? To find out, we need to look to the history and evolution of international law. Who made it and why? Who gets to enforce it and who gets to ignore it? To talk me through these crucial questions, I spoke to Alonso Gomendi, Alonzo is a lecturer at the Department of War Studies at King's College London and an expert in international law. Alonzo Gurmendi, thank you so much for joining me on Crash Course.
Good. Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start with the basics in terms of what is international law, because I understand domestic law. You know, you have a legislature that writes it. You have sort of some courts who decide if it's been broken. You have a prosecutor. You have the police to arrest people. You have prisons to send people to if they've broken it. With international law, you know, definitely not all of those exist. Maybe some of those exist. I mean, how can we understand international law in relation to domestic law, which I think most people will be a lot more familiar with?
Right. So just as a caveat, that's an entire, you know, college class trying to understand that. But keeping it like targeted, I'd say, I think it's important to understand what law is first, because I know there's this tendency to separate domestic law from international law, and try to say that one is more law-y than the other. But I think it is important to understand that law is not a neutral system. There's this very common definition that law is the system of rules that are all interconnected that allows people to solve their differences. And that is true in a sense. It is a system of rules, but it is not a neutral system of rules. I think we can all see, even in domestic law, how rules tend to favor, you know, massive corporations, lobby institutions. And so, yes, there is a difference between the two, but it is not that massive of a difference. So international law would be that part of that branch of law, that type of law that regulates the relationships between states. And because states are the, let's call it the sovereign units that doesn't accept anything on top of it, yeah, there are enforcement problems. And those enforcement problems then tend to be solved through, in international relations jargon, we say self-help. You know, each state figures out what to do. And so some states have more recourses, more resources, than others. Some need to tackle things through the law a lot more than others. If you have a stronger army, you don't need the law for that much. And that makes this, this creates this notion of, well, then international law is worthless. But laws and rules, are constructs. They're things that we create as humans, and we give them value. So if there's no one at an intersection in a stoplight and it's a red light, why do you stop if there's no cop, no camera? Right. So that is an aspect that also exists in international law. There's less supervision. That doesn't mean it is not law. And that doesn't mean that it cannot have an impact. Take, for example, the fact that 200 years ago, it was fairly normal for states to invade other states if they did not pay their foreign debt. And yes, there are economic coercion mechanisms alive and well today. But when Argentina went through this economic crisis in 2001, it wasn't invaded. And 200 years ago, it literally Argentina was. So there is an arc that moves slower than with domestic law, but the arc exists. And so the fundamental difference is one of enforcement, not so much of validity. And I would advise not to take it too far, because all law is both legal and political. And this idea that law is neutral and powerful in the domestic level, but, you know, biased and not very powerful in the international level, is not that true. All law is biased and all law is political.
You know, that's very interesting, that example about sort of debt repayments and invasions. So I suppose, you know, for someone who's not a sort of idealist about laws being sort of the perfect form of justice in the domestic sphere, let's say, one thing you can say for domestic law is that it does protect you from some of the arbitrariness of anarchy, let's say. And I suppose with international law, that seems to be more of an open question. Does it protect us from the arbitrariness of anarchy, or does it just sort of dress up anarchy as something else? Anarchy being, you know, purely might makes right without really any recourse to some form of justice, let's say. But as you're saying, you don't seem to think that, you know, international law is just dressing up international anarchy.
Well, I guess I'm saying, I would spin that around and say, I don't think that it is so different than domestic law, than what you're saying about in international law. So I do think we need to be aware that international law is a product of politics. It is made by states. States, try to protect their interests through this law. What I'm trying to say is more, that is what lobby groups do as well. So, the difference between both is not as pronounced as you would think. So instead of saying, no, international law is this perfect body of laws that promotes international justice. No, I don't think that's the case. I think international law is the product of, 18th century colonial, ideas. It is designed as a body of rules that will allow states to colonize half the world. That's when it was created. That was the purpose for which it was created. I just don't think that it is fair to say that, and therefore it is super flawed because it's not like domestic law. I would turn that around and say domestic law is as unfair, just in different ways. Because yeah, sure, there's no anarchy, but the problem with domestic law is the order that it creates.
It is another difference with international law and domestic law, that international law you can opt out. So sort of, as far as I understand it, the basis for international law is sort of treaties, whereby so you sign a treaty and then you are subject to it. And if you don't sign the treaty, you're not subject to it. Whereas in the domestic sphere, I'm subject to the law whether or not I have signed any kind of document. The mere fact of being born in a country means you are subject to the law. Whereas as far as I understand it, it's not so much the mere fact of a country existing in the world that makes it subject to international law. You often sort of hear, oh, this country has signed the Genocide Convention. It hasn't signed the Rome Statute, meaning it's subject to the International Criminal Court. And so it makes it seem a bit like international law is more pick and choose than domestic law.
It is, but with a caveat. The caveat to me is when enough states have ratified and joined a treaty, or when enough states do something similar, then it becomes customary law and then everyone needs to comply with it. So yes, there is that difference, that there is no, say, world parliament for international law. But then again, my counter argument to that is, are we really sure that parliaments work? Like, is it really uncontestable that then, because there is a parliament, there will be less injustice and there will be a lot more persecution of genocide at the domestic level? Because there also isn't. Genocide doesn't need to be prosecuted through international law. Neither do invasions. The experience in the UK is clear with that. There were inquiries into the Iraq war. All of that is domestic law. And if having these institutions and this, like, it's not pick and choose, if you will, made a relevant difference, then we would have seen people go to jail. Look at the financial crisis. We have all of these rules, all of these systems in place. Not a single banker went to jail.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, that's a good point. I suppose I'm less getting at sort of justice versus injustice, because I completely take that argument, and more about sort of arbitrariness versus non-arbitrariness. Sort of laws give you sort of predictability in a way that maybe, you know, sort of the realist exertion of power doesn't to such an extent. Let's make this more concrete, though. Let's talk about sort of the origins of some of these international laws. I had, you know, potentially in naive fashion, written down the Geneva Conventions as sort of a starting point for this, which, as far as I understood it, was sort of, you know, the European powers coming together and saying, how do we make war between each of us a bit less brutal? And, you know, it left out colonial wars. So it didn't protect really anyone but the Europeans. But I would have thought, sort of, I think the most basic understanding of this is these powers come together and say, if we're going to have wars, let's make them less brutal. I think you said earlier that these laws, in your mind, were basically created to enable colonialism. So I said, can you talk about the origins of international laws, whether or not you start that sort of with the Geneva Conventions?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a very big connection between international law and war. So that's an easy story to tell, because international law for a very long time was often called the law of war and peace. That was essentially what it did. So yes, I think it is important to understand where international law comes from, because we have this idea that it always existed in the way that it exists today. And so in the 16, 1700s, international law was more something that was in books and maybe some treaties here and there. But it wasn't this like systematized body of rules that had these like huge conventions, like the Geneva Convention or the Hague Convention that states signed up for. If it did, they were more like military alliances. And so this system that we have today, the way we understand international law comes from the 1800s with the advent of positivism. This idea that you can essentially reflect reality in a piece of paper and call it, you know, a code. You know, the Napoleonic code comes from this time. Like you can grab reality and regulate it perfectly. And so scholars tried to do that with international law. And what reality were they trying to convert into this like perfect code? Usually war and colonialism. And so there is this pattern, this way of understanding the history of international law as this story of progress from the least advanced to the most advanced, where we, of course, are the most advanced version of international law that there exists. And so the story goes like, oh, well, in the beginning, wars were free-for-alls. And then all of a sudden, we discovered that maybe it's better to be more, quote-unquote, civilized while fighting it. And so we, in 1864, we signed the Geneva Convention, the first Geneva Convention, to humanize war and to take care of the wounded. And then in 1863, the US did the same thing with the Civil War. They drafted a code for the laws of war. And then in the 1870s, there was another code. And then in the early 1900s, another code. And every single time, we, remember that word we kept improving the laws of war until we got to World War II. And World War II was so brutal, so horrible, that we drafted a code to be done with that work, the Geneva Conventions. And as I said in the beginning, like, I don't think that's how the law in general works. I don't think the law is free from political interference. And the political interference at that time was that these rules were meant to apply to European countries in European wars. But they didn't expect these laws to limit their ability to colonize the world. So a lot of the huge war crimes that we talk about, like targeting civilians and stuff like that, that happened in World War II, had been applied to people in Africa for decades without any remorse, without any, maybe we shouldn't do this. There's the famous example of the Dum Dum bullets, right? The bullets that were used by colonial powers, particularly the British in Africa. They were prohibited in regular war amidst between Europeans, but not for colonial wars, the so-called small wars, quote unquote. And so these rules, these Geneva Conventions that we have now today, are sort of a reaction to something that was never a problem for European states, which was colonialism. And so I place a lot more importance on the additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions than to the Geneva Conventions, because the additional protocols of the Geneva Conventions came about in the 70s. In the 70s, decolonizing countries and national liberation movements for the first time participated in the drafting of international law. And so they incorporated a bunch of rules that we now think are standard that weren't actually codified before that. Before that, the understanding was, if it's necessary for military purposes for you to do this, then do it. Military necessity was the overriding force. Now we don't think that way. And there is a big discussion between those who think that military necessity continues to be an overriding force, which be the US, Israel, and states with large militaries, and those who think that no, after that process between World War II and the additional protocols in the 1970s, the way we regulate war has changed and is changing. And we're in a process to now finally try to at least move it in the right direction. So it's not a moment of a line of continuous progress, but it's more like we're in a moment of trying to get rid of that legacy of colonial war from international law by incorporating the rules that these national liberation movements and states in Africa and Asia brought with them from their experience fighting colonialism. So it's an interesting battle to wage it comes from the understanding that the laws of war are a construct, and we are constructing it as we go along.
And so to clarify the difference between, well, not the original, so the Geneva Conventions, as they're often talked about, you know, as you say, they start in the 1800s, but the ones we work from now are pretty much founded in 1949. So when those 1949 ones are signed, that's mainly between, well, not necessarily the European powers, but the Western powers. That's when you sort of get torture outlawed. You've got to have a distinction between civilians and non-civilians. What else is in there?
So, for example, for the first time, because you had Nazi Germany occupying countries in Europe, for the first time, there's recognition that there are, how can I put this? There are moments where you need to recognize partisans, because usually partisans were in the colonies and they were hated in international law. If you rebelled against a European army in Europe, you basically had no rights. That was what happened during the Franco-Prussian War in the 1870s. You were supposed, as a civilian, you were supposed to not participate at all in hostilities. After World War II, we get that. We also get the recognition that there is such a thing as a non-international armed conflict between a state and a non-state actor. Because all of a sudden,
so you get protection for resistance fighters, right? Not they're not just seen as terrorists that you can just kill.
Right, as partisans, which was the jargon at the time. And then that, by the 1970s, that evolves into a recognition of national liberation wars as more than just internal conflicts, but as actual international wars for the liberation of peoples. So usually if you rebel against your government, you don't, international law does not recognize you a right to do it. You can be thrown in jail for doing that. You can be accused of murder for shooting a soldier, because it's not, you are not a state, right? You are rebelling against law. So you can have a right to participate in an armed conflict, and you will not be committing war crimes for engaging the armed forces of your state, but you will go to jail. You can be accused of murder for participating in hostilities. That's not what happens in regular war. When two states go to war, you could not charge a British soldier for war crimes during World War II. Sorry, for murder during World War II for killing a German soldier. That's not how it works. So after the 1970s, the big addition, the big controversial addition that national liberation movements included in the convention was the idea that if you are fighting colonialism or domination or racial domination, you should not be charged in this way as well. You should be recognized as a legitimate fighter in a legitimate war, not a rebel that can be thrown in jail for rebelling. You are a national liberation movement. This was unheard of. This was a massive shift in the way that international law worked, to the point that the United States and Israel have not recognized this treaty, have not signed it, and refuse to acknowledge that this is customary law, because it would potentially go against their interest.
Let's talk about the UN Charter. So, I mean, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I understand it, sort of the legal architecture of international law when it comes to humanitarian law comes a lot from the Geneva Conventions and then a lot from the UN Charter, which is what sort of countries signed as they joined the United Nations, the founding document of the United Nations, say. Also the Genocide Convention, which we'll get onto. But am I sort of on the right track there? Sort of the architecture comes from the Geneva Conventions, the UN Charter, and maybe a couple other treaties?
I think they are connected. I don't think they necessarily follow the same historical evolution. The purpose of the UN Charter was to organize the world after World War II in terms of international security. So the main thing that the UN Charter does, it says, okay, no more war. You cannot declare war on someone. Up until the UN Charter, maybe a little bit before that, in the 1920s and 30s, there were a few treaties here and there, one in South America, another one in Europe that tried to ban war, but this is the successful banning of war, and appoint, you know, a council of elders, the Security Council, to decide who gets to go to war and who doesn't. The main purpose of the UN Charter was to organize that process of banning war, putting the United States and its allies, including at the time the Soviet Union, at the top of the food chain. The Geneva Conventions speak to those objectives, because the UN, one of the points of the UN Charter, where the objectives of the UN Charter is to promote human rights. So the Geneva Convention sort of like can latch on to that and be part of that, like, essential rules of the world. But really, it follows a different history. the regulation of war exists since before the prohibition of war. And arguably they go against each other, because if you regulate war, this is actually what Samuel Moyn argues about in his book. We were talking about this earlier. If you regulate something, you make it normal. And so you perpetuate it in time. Whereas the UN Charter wanted to eliminate war as far as possible. So there is a little bit of a tension between war abolitionism and war humanization.
And the Nuremberg trials were also interesting in this, because the Nuremberg trials, lots of people will know, this is where, you know, the Nazis were trialed after, or put on trial, sorry, after or prosecuted after the Second World War. Now, I think most people sort of assume that they were prosecuted for the Holocaust, right? When we think of the Second World War and we think of war crimes, that's what we think of. But actually, they were principally prosecuted for starting a war. So there's a famous quote from, I think it's in the final verdict, or the final judgment from the judges. To initiate a war of aggression, therefore, is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. So sort of after the Second World War, the immediate response was that the main thing the Nazis did that was wrong, or the principal thing they did was wrong, was in wars of aggressions with their neighbours. We seem to have moved away from the idea that sort of starting a war is the worst thing you can do, and we hear a lot more about how people behave once a war has begun. I don't know if you could sort of speak to that. Was there a moment when sort of world powers thought the worst thing you can do is start a war, and now they say, well, war is inevitable, you just got to try and not torture people while you're carrying it out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very famous international law historian, Martti Koskeniemi, he's from Finland, who argues that international law really wobbles between being completely apologetic for whatever states do at any given time. And so the rules of international law sort of like veer towards saying we are very close to practice of whatever states do. And so anything states do is legal, so it becomes apologetic. And on the other hand, every so often, every hundred years, every few decades, wobbles back to a more utopian, more like, I don't care what states do. They went too far, and now we're going to put a rule here that says that you cannot do that. And so international law would go following these trends between apology and utopia, between saying whatever states do is legal to, no, we need to have some clear rules. And I think this is something like what you're describing here, that there's always been, I guess maybe today there's a smaller anti-war movement, but there's always been a difference between those who want to eliminate war and those who want to humanize. And one is more apologetic and one is more utopian, right? I think after World War II, there was a lot of excitement about the possibility of ending war. This happened also after World War I. As the world moves on, you start seeing this like, oh, but we really do need to invade X country, right? So these very idealistic rules start to wane in importance in this like apology and utopia wobble that I'm describing. So yeah, I think you are definitely on to something when you say this. Just look at what happened to the crime of aggression at the International Criminal Court. It's very difficult to charge a state for aggression nowadays. Yeah, I think you're right. I think right now we're in a moment where people accept, well, leaders accept that, well, we need to go to war, and eliminating war altogether is seen as like this absurd proposition because we have the UN. So we've done everything we could. And I think there's still a lot more room for like, continuing that trend of saying, no, war is not acceptable. Least of all aggressive war, right?
And specifically, I suppose, you know, because the charter, the UN charter does seem quite idealistic. It does seem like, you know, we've come here together to stop war. And I suppose it does give the UN power to call a war and a war of aggression and therefore illegal. But it has this fundamental flaw, which is that everyone on the Security Council has a veto of that. So the United States can never be found to have started an aggressive war because they've got a veto. Russia can never be found to have started a war of aggression because they've got a veto. And then obviously France, the UK, China on there as well. I think it's the case that since 1945, Russia and America have started more wars than we have, but I could be wrong there. But is it that veto that is the real issue? If the big powers can never be found to have committed a war of aggression, then you're not going to end war.
Yeah, I think So I'm going to go back to what I said in the beginning about war, about law being a product of politics. We started in 1945 with a UN charter that says you can only go to war if someone attacks you first, so in self-defense, or if the Security Council authorizes you. And we've been seeing how little by little this very simple set of rules have started to be watered down, mostly because of the way that the law works, from the perspective of that first prompt that you can only go to war for defensive purposes. So not so much with regards to the if the Security Council authorizes you angle. So what we've been seeing is it started in the 1990s, well, maybe a little bit earlier, but like it started with the idea of, well, maybe we can go to war if the purpose of the war is to protect people from gross abuses. We saw this in the late 1990s, in the mid-1990s with the Rwanda genocide, no one intervened, and it was like, how is this possible? Then we had the Kosovo NATO intervention to save Kosovars, and then we had the R2P concept, responsibility to protect concept in 2000s. And then, of course, the war in Iraq happened. Everyone went like, oh, okay, so if you allow states an excuse to intervene in a country, they will use it for whatever purpose. Don't send blank checks to states. And so we had that humanitarian intervention was the first attempt at watering down that self-defense limitation. Then there was anticipatory self-defense, which was what the US did in Iraq. Like, do I really need to wait for that country to attack me so that I can attack it? I mean, the answer in 1945 would have been like, yes, you do need to wait until there's no other way for you to stop an attack. Like, the attack is coming. You do need to wait. But the US said, oh, maybe if they construct these weapons that they didn't really have, eventually in some time they might maybe attack me. That's also self-defense. And now we are in this situation where what the United States says is, I am in a war against all terrorist groups all over the world. And if a state has a presence in its borders of a terrorist group, that's a threat to me. And if I consider that state to be unwilling or unable to control that threat, then I have a right to defend myself against that threat, which is an absolute watering down of that immediacy requirement, like the requirement that self-defense needs to be necessary. There really needs to be no other way for you to protect yourself than self-defense. So now it's basically a unilateral test to see where I can drone or where I can, which country can I bomb? Like, international law has become a little bit, not so much when can you bomb, but where can you bomb? Like, what spaces can you apply this unwilling or unable standard to bomb people? Like, I'm currently in London, right? I am not worried that if there is someone from a terrorist group living in the flat next to me, that the UK or the US will dispatch a drone and destroy the entire apartment complex I'm in. I'm not worried about that. But if that person that's next door starts traveling around the world, eventually they will get to a place where the rationale will be, oh, it's self-defense now. Now I can destroy the entire apartment complex, right? That's what's happening right now in Israel, right? Where the presence of weapons in one flat, in one building, means that you can destroy the entire building. And so we have seen this complete watering down of the notion of self-defense. And the response to that usually is like, well, what else do you want us to do? Right? We need to control these threats. The world is a dangerous place. And there's a response there is like, well, but maybe the Security Council should work. And you're like, well, but they go, but it doesn't. So we need to do something. Like, yeah, but why is it that what we need to do is to water down the protections of global South states so that they can be invaded, destroyed, bombed as the, what else are we going to do? Instead of, taking power away from the powerful countries so that the enforcement mechanism of international law can work better. So reform or remove the veto power entirely. It is always global South sovereignty that has to be watered down. It is never global North power.
And so I suppose, to sort of, it might be helpful to look at some scenarios here, because this is where the Security Council, to me, seems to be very sort of key in terms of when a war or a military intervention is legal or illegal or some sort of grey area in between. So if say a small African country invades another small African country and they say it's, you know, preemptive self-defense, but no one really believes it, then the Security Council could say, we are passing this Security Council resolution, which says this is a war of aggression, and we're going to encourage everyone to sanction this country, and we're going to send in some peacekeepers. And that would be legal.
I mean, we don't need a hypothetical. That's what happened in the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, right? In fact, in Africa, particularly under the ECOWAS countries, this is something that is very regulated because the UN Charter allows regional organizations to organize regional security without the need for Security Council intervention. And so in the ECOWAS countries, they have decided when can force be used. And so we're seeing this very interesting process where African countries are saying, when there's a coup, this council can decide to intervene. And that sort of works within the framework of the UN Charter, because there's a regional organization that's deciding these things. It's not just unilateral. In Latin America, there's a very strong prohibition against war. During the Trump years, Trump was frequently insisting, let's maybe invade Venezuela. And you had the Bolsonaro government in Brazil and the Duque government in Colombia, which were incredibly conservative, objecting to that, saying, no, that's not how we do things here. Here we go to the OAS, here we go to the Rio group or whatever, and we solve our differences. I mean, it's interesting to see, to me, how like the spaces of the global South sort of have figured out how to solve their own crisis. Not perfectly, but I mean, there's still a lot of conflict in Africa, but at least in interstate war, it is a little bit regulated in the absence of the Security Council already. So the example, the real world example is Iraq invades Kuwait, and the UN says you can liberate Kuwait. That actually did happen. And the original design of the UN Charter was, and then we send the UN army there, which was going to be the Blue Helmets. You know, that army was never created. And so it became, and now you know, coalition of the willing can go invade and rescue Kuwait. But yeah, that's the one time it's happened.
And did they try? Well, I suppose that wasn't interstate so much, but say with the example of Serbia and Kosovo, so NATO basically said, we need to protect the Kosovans from aggression by Serbia, even though Kosovo was, you know, a part of Serbia at the time, but we need to, you know, save the people of Kosovo, basically. But they didn't have Security Council permission to do that, I think, because Russia would have blocked it. But they intervened anyway, which made that intervention illegal. But lots of people went along with it because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't so obviously cynical, let's say, as either the invasion of Iraq or now Russia invading Ukraine. But it was still illegal. But because, you know, no one could do anything about it. I mean, how do we think about this? I'm tying myself in knots a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, there's these catchphrases, right? It was lawful but awful, or it was illegal but legitimate. And I think so. It's part of this watering down of the international regime of self-defense. Actually, Serbia sued NATO before the International Court of Justice. It is one of those famous cases. It didn't go to trial. It didn't finish as a case. But there were some interesting arguments. Belgium, for example, argued in that case that NATO was not really violating the UN Charter, because the UN Charter says that you cannot use force against another state against its territorial integrity or its political independence. And what Belgium said is, I am neither trying to take away part of Serbia, so I'm not going against its territorial integrity, nor trying to change the way they work or do things, so I'm not going against their political independence. So what I'm doing is legal. And this is the rationale for humanitarian intervention, like unilateral humanitarian intervention, that even the UK used against Syria recently. Most states in the global South reacted with no, come on, that's not how it was meant to be regulated. What was supposed to happen is we were supposed to have a UN Security Council resolution. So instead of saying, let's water down the prohibition of war, you should have said, let's water down the veto. But politics got in the way. So the reaction to that was the responsibility to protect concept, which is a private initiative, started in Canada, and then it was adopted by states in around 2005. That said, that there was a sort of like a process to follow that was not just reactive, but proactive, as in it states that there should be a recognized rule that states need to be responsible for their governments never committing these mass atrocities. So there's a responsibility to prevent as much as there's a responsibility to protect. And originally this was going to be the main proposal to jump over the veto power and say, look, if we follow these rules, then we can jump over the Security Council and nothing will happen because everyone will be following these rules. And things got very interesting. Like, there was a massive report on this in 2001 that essentially suggested, like, maybe in some cases it could be legal if we just don't listen to the Security Council. But then Iraq happened and everyone sort of like went from utopian to, oh my God, this is going to be a nightmare. And so that sort of, in 2005, when all the states in the world got together to decide whether, you know, R2P was going to be a thing, they said, yes, we like this idea that we need to prevent mass atrocity as a rule. But then when it comes to the part of protecting, when it comes to invading, to invade, you need Security Council authorization. And so we went back to zero. So yeah, we are at a, the way I see it is we are in a discussion between what is it that needs to yield so that we can achieve a better organization for our world. Is it global South sovereignty or is it global North power? And so far, it's only been global South sovereignty. And that's why I think until we as a world, as an international community, come together and say, okay, both need to yield a little bit, it's going to be an impossible impasse. The global South states are never going to accept this, and global North states are going to try to impose it through, you know, power politics.
And to be clear, the former yielding would, so the global North powers yielding would be them weakening their veto on the Security Council. So saying, you know, one of these five arbitrarily chosen states can't just veto anything that has any power in the Security Council or in the UN.
Yeah, so it's the US, the UK, France, China, and Russia that have a veto power within a council of 15 member states, right? It's a all permanent members need to vote in favor, need to not veto, need to not say no, they can abstain. And then there needs to be a majority of members of the council that say yes. So if half of the states say yes, and in that half are all five Security Council members, then it's a go. Otherwise, if one permanent member says no, then it's a no. And so the proposals that are there, like to work on veto reform, are, for example, incorporating more permanent members. Say, for example, an African country, South Africa is one of those candidates. Incorporating Brazil, for example, is another big candidate to join the Security Council. India is another one. And so incorporate more countries so that we have a more diverse set of angles here. And at the same time, make it so that it's not just one veto. Limit it in some way. Either you can only make a fixed amount of vetoes, or you need to have more than one veto. Like, you need to have two or three vetoes for that to count as a veto. I don't think anyone is proposing to do away with the veto entirely, because, like, politics, yeah, some way of limiting this. There's different proposals on the table.
So I want to talk about the Genocide Convention. So the Genocide Convention, founded, again, in the 1940s, sort of, we said in the Nuremberg trials, they were talking more about wars of aggression. And then clearly, for good reason, some legal scholars sort of thought we need to talk more about genocide and sort of make this specifically something which is prohibited. Why did they need a new treaty for that? Why could they not have sort of incorporated that in the Geneva Conventions or the UN Charter or something else? Why did we need a specific convention against genocide?
Oh, that's a good question. So I think the main thing is, at the time, the Genocide Convention was designed to address the situation of European Jews fleeing the Holocaust. It was then expanded to cover everything else. But it's a product of its time. The concept of genocide was created by, I think he was Polish international scholar by last name Lemkin. And he was trying to reflect sort of like this thing that he was seeing first in Turkey, then in Europe, where an entire community, nation was like exterminated, the Armenians, Jewish people, through this thing that he called genocide. And so there was a momentum to regulate it. It could have been incorporated into the Geneva Conventions, but I think just because of political circumstances, it received its own special treatment. Sort of the same thing that happened with apartheid. There's a convention against apartheid. It's not in the Geneva Conventions. So I don't think there's anything obscure or like shady about it. It's just the way that politics worked. The interesting thing is that it was contentious at the time, how you regulate this. There's something similar happens with the refugee convention, right? So there was an idea of what genocide is in the minds of some states, which wasn't necessarily the idea that Lemkin had. Lemkin had a much broader concept of genocide than what just happened in the Holocaust, right? And so one of the main concerns by the United States, for example, was we have this general set of rules that are designed to address, to respond to what happened in Europe during the Holocaust. And the United States said, and that is good. But these rules, this is the thing with the law, these rules did not say genocide is the Holocaust, right? It did not say specifically Jewish people are protected. It just said whenever there's a genocide, you get protection, right? And so the United States was very worried that other communities might claim genocide protections, namely African-Americans, because of the Jim Crow era and the segregationist policies at the time. This is 1948, right? So pre any civil rights movement. And so when the United States participated in this negotiation for the treaty, it tried to make sure that the protections of the Genocide Convention did not reach its own borders, that they could not be accused of genocide. In fact, there's a very interesting document called We Charge Genocide that was written by African-American communities in the United States, arguing that now that the Genocide Convention was in force, it could be used to, you know, fight against Jim Crow and like segregation policies, because that was genocide.
Why would that have been genocide? I mean, I can see why it would be apartheid, but sort of like the United States weren't killing black people in the South, were they? I suppose there were lynchings, but
right. But it was so the argument would be that it was. You know how right now we're discussing at the ICJ not just whether Israel is committing genocide, but whether it is sanctioning people who commit genocide? Something similar like that. It's like there is a genocide going on in the United States with lynching everywhere, and we didn't have that language of apartheid yet. And yet the United States is doing nothing to protect that community. If anything, it is collaborating with the KKK, it is collaborating with white supremacists to enable that genocide. It was a very contentious claim. It didn't go anywhere, but it's not, it shouldn't have been out of the question. It was just out of the question because of the politics of the time. There is an interesting argument. A Palestinian scholar, I believe his name is Rafea Ekbadi. I may be wrong about this, and I'm sorry. I'll let you know later if I was right. He wrote an article recently, an article that was rejected by the Harvard Journal, and then published later in another magazine, talking about how we name crimes and how that matters. Because you mentioned that I could understand how that is apartheid. Yes, but we didn't have a word for apartheid back then. We only created that crime, in the context of South Africa, and we created genocide in the context of Armenia and the Holocaust, like the Turkish genocide of Armenians and the German extermination of Jewish people during World War II. And so we create these like massive crimes in response to massive atrocity. And his argument was that these massive crimes should not be seen as fixed things in time. Like, oh, is this a genocide or is it not a genocide? Because that name was created in a specific context with specific facts. So his proposal was, what we're seeing right now in what we're seeing right now with the genocide accusation against Israel, should not be constructed as a genocide. It's a Nakba. And the Nakba should be seen as its own international crime with its own aspects and specificities. And the fact that we are not able to say this is a Nakba as an international crime, but we were able to say, let's create something called the Apartheid Convention for South Africa, is part of the problem. And so he says, like, okay, you can claim that this isn't a genocide, but it is a Nakba. And I found that very interesting. It goes to your question of why did this receive its own convention? And I guess the counterpoint to that is, what heinous crimes receive their own identity and what heinous crimes don't, and why?
That was the first part of my conversation with Alonso Gomendi. To listen to the rest of the interview, you can sign up for as little as £3 a month at patreon.com/crashcoursepod. That's patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Crash Course is hosted by me, Michael Walker. Production and editing is by Lewis Bassett and Patrick Herdman. Patrick Herdman does the sound design.